So for the second session of this morning, before lunch, we have two talks, another pair of two theory talks. And the first talk is by Gabi Kotliar from Rutgers University, who will tell us how to identify the mechanism of superconductivity in the cuprate superconductors. I look forward to the answer.
Okay, so first I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to be here. It's always very exciting to be here in Paris, and I took my mission in the spirit of a discussion, and I have to make directly an apology. I didn't have very much time to prepare my talk because my laptop broke down, and it's only 2 hours ago that I really got my computer back. I mean, so to quote Thierry Jamarchi, in the epic battle between human stupidity and artificial intelligence, this time artificial intelligence definitely won. So it's not terribly well prepared, but the spirit is the spirit of discussion, and I would like to sort of say how I would go about identifying the mechanism of superconductivity in the cuprates and other high-temperature superconductors. So I will certainly start sort of with methods or what we need to do, because we need sort of somehow to agree on methodology. And I think the theory has to make predictions that then are tested experimentally. So the stress is really on predictions. And when they work, I think one gains more confidence in the methodology. And even when don't completely work, when they're only partially borne out by experiment, I think that even then it leads to further progress and better methodologies. And I will give concrete examples of that. So it's just a discussion about methodology, how we can go about solving this conundrum that we've been facing for more than 25 years. And for a theorist, it's hard because we need to search for universal features and then for simplified pictures, but we also need to understand material dependence. So there is really a compromise that has to be made all the time between speed and accuracy, between simple fixtures and the full quantitative results. But we should not forget what is the ultimate goal here. I mean, the reason why we're trying to understand the pseudo gap and all these broken symmetries is because ultimately we would like to understand materials. So understanding the mechanism, the reason we want to understand is because then we would like to use insights and then suggest concrete materials to the experimentalists which would have interesting properties and which can be made in the lab. So I think that when we reach this point, there will be consensus on what the pseudo gap is and the rest of the mystery which surrounds the cuprates. And we're working towards that goal. We're not exactly there yet, but my feeling is that we're much closer than when the field of correlated materials began in earnest, which was with the high TCs in the 1980s. And lots of progress has been made in understanding strongly correlated materials. And now, thanks to dynamic mid-field theory, we have much more powerful theoretical tools that actually translate into more predictive capabilities in the materials arena. So what I want to discuss is really predictive power in this talk. And that's going to be the theme of what I'm going to tell you about. So, predictive power of what? One has to understand the strength and limitations of a method. So, all my talk will be built on mean field theories. And one has to understand the limitations and the power. Mean field theory, what it does, divides the problem in two parts. We study different states, and then we evaluate the relative stability of those states. And then it's a strength and a liability. It's a strength because for design, you want that. You want to be able to follow a state as you vary parameters. And by comparing different states, we get an understanding of mechanism, provided that we have a good handshake with the experiment, provided that we have predictive power. We know what's left out, and many of the things which are really dear to my friends are really left out, things which happen at extremely long wavelength. And I think one of the things that we need to ascertain is how important these things are. I'm not saying they're not there, they're just excluded from the results that I'm explaining. Now, what we want is to build a bridge between atomic information and physical spectroscopical properties. And I think that we find the right coordinate system in the space of materials, we find interesting materials. There are also limitations, and the limitations come because of the nature of the problem we're dealing. And I'll give you evidence that at low temperatures, we really have many different order states. And this requires some guesswork, and we don't have the ultimate answer there. In principle, one can think of going to large clusters, but then there are issues that need to be discussed in terms of understanding the effect of boundary conditions. But the most important thing in all this is to really understand the limitations and the natures of the error of the approximation. There's nothing wrong with having an approximate method. I mean, there's been an obsession among my friends in getting exact solutions. I think approximations are okay, provided that you understand the nature of the approximations and the errors you're making. And the classic example is density functional theory in the field of weakly correlated materials. You know when you do a DFT, you know on which side you're erring. And when you know on which side you're erring, you have predictive power, okay? Now, how I will illustrate these things? Well, I have three exhibits. Exhibit number one, I will comment on the early days of HITC and the things that we were able to predict using Slay boson mean field theory methods. And some of them, I think, connect remotely to the things that Louis is interested in, for example, issues of charge order. And of course, I will also say some things about how we look at the same things with a little bit more powerful methods, or much more powerful methods, such as cluster dynamic and mean field theory. And I made an effort not to overlap with the very, very nice talk that André Marie has already given and Andy has given, will give after me. So then I will switch to exhibit two. And now this is very old work. And I will only talk about new things in the second part, where I will show some theoretical predictions so you guys can judge exactly where we are. And I took a page from what Steve Kivelson did in taking the field of MCTIDEs, and I will show you a new iron MCTIDE family, the 112 family of the iron MCTIDEs. That's a family that was entirely predicted theoretically. It didn't exist for iron in the ICSD database. And I'll try to argue that this type of exercise, again, this prediction experiment loop, is extremely useful, and this should be used to understand many of the issues that you're concerned about in the field of nematicity. So that's my second exhibit. And my exhibit number three goes directly to the title of the talk, and I'd like to introduce a new material. Again, it's not in the ICSD database, but it's my best bet now of how you would make an interesting high-temperature superconductor. So if I have time, I'd like to show you what goes into the design of something like this. So that's the plan of the talk, and I'll start sort of with the very beginning of the field of modern strongly correlated electron systems, which is with the HITC, and with the ideas of Anderson, and that if we want to understand strongly correlated materials, we need to understand Mott insulators and how Mott insulators relate to high temperature superconductivity. And I'll start with the work of Bhaskar and Zhu and Anderson, where they focus on basically two things: that sometimes the residue, the quasiparticle residue, goes to zero and it's represented by a Slay boson, but more important, that we need to look at the correlation between spins in terms of two bond variables. And basically, based on this, they focused on uniform solutions of certain set of mean field equations, which gave rise to S-wave superconductivity and set the stage for this field of strongly correlated materials in my mind. Now, following up on that, they only consider S-wave, and they, at that time, the center was really to obtain a set of uniform solutions to this set of equations, which describes certain S-wave, and set the stage for later work that we did, and also Ian Affleck and Brad Marston did, in which one started to realize that those bond variables that had already been introduced in the BZA treatment, in fact, had life of their own. And when one solves a little bit better those mean field equations, one finds very, very clearly already in 1987 that this type of local correlations between the pairs in near neighbors bond lead to D-wave superconductivity. So I think this was a clear prediction at the time of that contains some essence of the truth of the problem. Even now that we have very, very powerful methods for solving the DMFT equations, and we need both powerful methods and simplified methods, one can see two things, that the J physics is essential for treating cuprates, and it's not essential at high temperatures in other oxides. And second, that leads to D-wave superconductivity. Now, those bond variables are very, very important, and I have feeling they are linked by an SU2 symmetry, which was introduced by Affleck et al. And further studies of these equations show that in the underdog cuprates, there are really many possible solutions. And that's an important clue to what follows later on. Okay, so we had to learn how to treat electrons when we are very far from lambda Fermi liquid asymptote. Okay, so that leads to this phase diagram that now is very well known, where we have a pseudo gap phase when the pairs are formed, in the sense that we have spin pairs which are incoherent, but at low temperatures we have D-wave superconductivity and we have a dome, and then we have a normal state which is a Fermi liquid. So this is sort of well known. What is sort of less known in this community is that we did further work on that, and we investigated what happens in this SUN limit for large N. Subir did some work on SPN limit for large N, and it turns out that yes, there are these solutions, but if we look at low temperatures, low energies, there are many other solutions. There are dimer states, there are nematic states, which were found already in 1992. Furthermore, if one takes the flux state, for example, and tries to see whether it's stable or unstable, one finds that it has linear instabilities towards incommensurate states. And in my mind, these are the two order parameters that were considered, and we showed that there is a tendency to form incommensurate order and condense these order parameters. So this would be an incommensurate density wave. So this order parameter, the spins are summed over, couples to charge. So this is what's called now a charge density wave or a bond density wave. And there are some issues in the sense that the spirit of this thing is that those are spins. So there are SU2 symmetries that relates the spin and the pair density wave, but those objects are supposed to carry no charge. So this is sort of spin, this would be like a pair density wave of spinners. And I think that's relevant to the discussion that we were having before. How can you have the pair density wave and have conductivity which is not that of the superconductor? Because essentially we are trying to model the pairing of incoherent objects with this sort of very primitive language. But all that was already known in 1990. So in my mind, this is a prediction of an incommensurate density wave that comes from the pairing of those objects on links. Okay, now we go to the modern era, to cluster DMFT. And cluster DMFT retains all the goodies of the old Slay-Boson mean field theory, but it's a much more powerful language. It removes many, many, many of the shortcomings of the primitive description for many reasons. First, now lifetimes and the incoherent part of the electron spectral function is really included explicitly and fully in the form of a fully an omega-dependent object. Second, one finds some new features that we couldn't describe in the old language, like, for example, the strong anisotropy of the quasiparticle weight, the nodal antinodal dichotomy, and it's really a new powerful language when we cannot use Fermi liquid theory. And I think this is, again, the major shortcoming that weak coupling approaches have. They're trying to describe something which cannot be force-fed into the language of ordinary Fermi liquid quasi-particles, which I assume that your RG already has gone to some very clear Fermi liquid point where you can do many things that in reality you can't. So you need a new language, and this dynamical mean field theory and the cluster extensions provided such a language. The problem why there's no, I mean, I believe that this clarifies what's the pseudo gap and regards all the other instabilities that we found in slave boson mean field theory as secondary instabilities. So the formation of the pairs is the matter. And then already in the simplest approaches, we can see that the pairs ultimately have to form a charge density wave. So in my opinion, these issues are pretty settled. The reason why I think they're not settled in the community is because by the time that cluster DMFT was developed, there were very few things left to predict. Most of the things that we're discussing were observed by experiment, and there were few predictions. I mean, here we, in terms of sort of language, here I have 2-3 papers which stress that indeed now we view the formation of the pseudo gap as an orbitally selective mode transition in momentum space. This is sort of a very, very, very succinct description. But there were not too many things, not too many smoking guns that one can actually tell the experimentalist. One prediction, which was in this paper, was that if you look at the underdoped response and you look at the typical scattering rate in the electron lifetime that enters in the optical conductivity, that would have a Fermi liquid-like dependence. And that was sort of observed experimentally in a very, very nice experiment by Dirk van der Marel. But there were not too many predictions of that sort. But so this is sort of the language, and this is taken from the paper of Michel Ferrero. This is taken from a paper with Christian Haule. I mean, if one looks at what happens in the underdoped regime, one sees that there are lots of singlets. In one is in the overdoped regime, one sees that the Fermi liquid theory distribution of local states sort of applies. If one looks in momentum space, there are arcs at low doping. There is a full Fermi surface in the overdoped region. This is sort of the line which André Marie dubbed the Widom line. There's also another line on the overdoped side, which is a coherence-incoherence crossover, which has attracted less attention experimentally, but Campuzano has studied. And then here, there is the maximum of TC. So that's sort of the modern version of the phase diagram that I showed you before. Okay, so now some caveats. This is only good for naive pictures. If we want to go to materials, and these materials are at the brink of the charge transfer instability. They are not way in the large U regime or the small U regime. NCCO has a U slightly less than the critical U. LASCO has a U slightly bigger than the critical U. Okay, so now I go to the exhibits fairly quickly. So the second exhibit is the setting is the aronictites. These are all the families that you know about the aronictites. We have a theory of the aronictites. They're Hund's metals. They're completely different than the Mott insulators. And we have lots of predictions that we made here using LDA plus DMFT, but now we want to push the ball a little bit further and try to really say, well, can we make a new material? So we did make a new material, and that's the 112 family. This is iron, barium or calcium or strontium, iron, arsenic 2. And it's different than the 1-2-2 family that people have studied. And what's interesting about this family, this is sort of the paper, 2009, we were forced to put that these are hypothetical compounds because they're hypothetical compounds. They did not exist. But we predicted a very distinctive feature. They have two layers. This is an ironictite ordinary layer. But the second layer actually is a very good metal. So the idea is to make a material where we have the ironictites separated by a metallic layer. Okay, so that was sort of the theoretical prediction. And well, for a long time, we thought we were careless in something, but now 2004, some relative has already appeared. That's calcium 1 minus X lanthanum X that superconducts at 43 Kelvin. And more recently, the group of Nini has managed to make the complete phase diagram of these things. And one can look at the magnetism, and one can look also at the superconductivity. And we can also see where the theory was quite good, but it was not perfect because we were not as careful as we should have been, in the sense that, well, this material exists and there is a very, very good metallic layer, which is very important. It turns out that because the layer is metallic, it undergoes a slight pyrrhus instability and forms zigzag chains, which I'm trying to illustrate here. So this is sort of the structure, the 3D view, and this is the 2D view. So we almost have the square net that we predicted. However, there's a slight distortion, and we have one-dimensional chains. So this material is a natural material to try to sort out all these issues with uniaxial pressure, because nature is applying the uniaxial pressure for you. Okay, this is your uniaxial pressure. It's selecting an A-axis. Furthermore, the orbitals which are here hybridized, which are the orbitals which are there. And furthermore, there is a monodomain sample. Okay, because you have these chains, there's only one domain of the material. Okay, so you see, the theory was not perfect, it was almost perfect, but even when you're not almost perfect, even when you miss something, if the approach is sound, it's very interesting. And this is a little bit more about the paper. There is the work of Nini. There is basically photoemission, and here you can see the Fermi surfaces, and we're already getting accustomed to this. One does the MFT calculations, one does the experiment, the photoemission looks pretty good. What I want to draw your attention is that now this is nematic. You have here a new Fermi surface, and this has strong arsenic content from the chains. So it's an interesting thing to study. So now I'll summarize this point. The original motivation for proposing the compound was to try to differentiate between mechanisms. The idea was that, well, if it's excitonic and you put a layer which is metallic, that will bump up the excitonic contribution so the TC should go through the roof. If it's magnetic, it should be more or less the same. The conclusion for me is that the mechanism is magnetic because this behaves like all the run-of-the-mill materials that we know very well in the aeronictite family. So that's how I think we should go about deciding about mechanisms. And I think a lot will be learned about these compounds, and I don't have time to discuss that because I want to say something about Exhibit 3. So Exhibit 3 is what's happened with the copper oxides, and I want to advertise for the chemists and the people who have the power to make materials to look at this one, and I want to show you the rationale how we go towards building this one. Okay? But I have to start from the beginning. I have to give credit where the credit is due. This starts with the work of Ole Andersen, and Ole looked at all the copper oxides and found some correlation between the critical temperature of the family, the TC max, and T prime over T. And even though there's a lot of scatter in these plots, the correlation is clear. Then we came, so we was very interested in that, and I worked actually with a chemist motivated by this, that was Martha Greenblatt, who managed to reduce nickel oxide enough so as to make it look like a cuprate, and indeed we got a Fermi surface with a very large T prime. We got nickel to be sufficiently reduced that it's beginning to look at the cuprate, but there was no trace of TC, and that got me really interested in this. And then work with Cedric Weber, where we re-examine Ole Andersen's work, and the point is that correlation doesn't mean causation. We can reproduce completely Ole Andersen's results. This is TC max versus T prime over T. But what's varying when you move between the different materials is not only T prime over T, but is in fact the charge transfer energy. So according to these calculations that Cedric did, if you really want to increase TC, TC max is going like this. What you need to do is you need to reduce a little bit the charge transfer energy. So that's our guiding principle. That's the hypothesis that we would like to test, because we showed with microscopic calculations that it's the charge transfer energy that needs to be reduced. Okay, so then comes the next step in the material design. One sort of proceeds naively. The first idea that we had is let's go and take the apical oxygen and replace it by a sulfur. And it's not so easy to make, even in theory. But if we do that, we would learn something. And indeed, this is the range of charge transfer energies that a compound like that would actually produce. So we would be able to reduce the charge transfer gap. It would do another thing. There's a competing theory. The idea of that theory being that what's important, what governs the physics, is actually the amount of z-square orbital that is present near the Fermi surface. And this compound was sort of nice because indeed it gives you a different range. The sulfur compounds give you a different range that you would have in the cuprates. So these are the cuprates, and these are the materials we propose. And in principle, if any of these things could be synthesized, it would allow you to probe between these different ideas. So this is a way, again, of testing and moving forward in terms of discriminating between mechanisms. But there was a problem that in these materials, and we discussed that explicitly in our paper, and that's why we did not recommend very strongly to make that material. And that's because they have a new form of distortion. And we don't know really what these distortions would do. So this is not my bet, okay? So now I go to my bet. I have 5 minutes. So
2 minutes,
okay. So now I'll tell you, so we decided now to go the final step. We want to find something that doesn't have those distortions. So the idea is to take something which is almost perfect, the mercury compound, and actually go one step further and make it perfect. So in the mercury compound is perfect because each layer has a role. This is the copper oxide layer, which produces the superconductivity. This is a neutral layer, which completely decoupled this from the dopants, which are here. So what we're going to do now is very modest. We're just going to mess around with this neutral layer, and we're going to try to improve the compound. So what we did is we asked the question, what if we take here X and Y, and we look over the thousands of possibilities of what is the best X and Y. And to do that, we have a strategy, first chemical arguments to restrict the search. Then we want to get rid of these distortions, so we require local stability and checking the phonons. And then we check for the global stability of the structure. And then basically we did the best we could, and that's basically how we arrived to this mercury calcium S2, copper O2. And it's going to be interesting because it's in a very, very interesting region of the phase diagram. So that's a prediction for the chemist to make. And it even has a slighter, shorter copper-copper distance. So if I was a grad student, I would go to the lab and I would try to make this. So with this, I will thank you for your attention. And I can also answer other questions.
Thank you very much, Gabriel.